The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the world of books and film and streaming TV and much more. We have an excellent show for you this week, as always. This is not a political program by any means, but there has been an intersection between American politics and popular culture, even more than usual in the last week. Presidential candidate Donald Trump keeps invoking Hannibal Lecter on the campaign trail, and his vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, is a literary memoirist, and that has invoked some very outraged reactions from the American literary community. And we're going to talk about that with Adam Hirschfelder, who is one of our contributors, and Adam will also be by to talk about the disastrous rollout of Kevin Costner's Horizon film series, which was supposed to be a 12-hour, four-part movie about the American West, but it has fallen on hard times, as has Yellowstone, which was Costner's previous Western franchise. And we're also going to talk to our contributor Jake Harris about Twisters, which is a fun and red beat weather porn movie that is in theaters now. You all will enjoy watching things get blown away by tornadoes in Oklahoma if you see it. And we'll be right back to talk to Adam Hirschfelder about American politics and pop culture after this musical interlude. We don't talk about politics much on this podcast, but we talk about political matters when it related to censorship or other book industry stuff. But we rarely talk about electoral politics because this is a cultural affairs podcast after all. But this has been a very strange election season, even by American standards. So, and there's been a lot of intersection between sort of the book and film world and the presidential election. There's a couple of things I wanted to talk about, and I brought Adam Hirschfelder, who is a Book and Film Globe contributor and someone I've been talking about politics with for a very long time. He's a very astute observer and commentator on the political scene. Not a professional commentator, just an amateur commentator. I'm trying to semi-professionalize him. And Adam is here today to talk to me about certain developments in politics. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Neil.
Yes. So this is it. Your punditry career has begun right here. Your moment. It's your moment. It's your star moment. This is like your, this is the closest you're going to get to talking to George Stephanopoulos.
Did we go hear Jerry Brown in college back in 1991 when he was like,
probably, I don't know. I don't remember. I was probably stoned. I don't know. So here's what I wanted to talk about. There are a couple of things that we've covered on Book and Film Globe. The first is the ascension of Ohio Senator J.D. Vance to the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party. This is significant for a number of reasons. You know, he's under 40. He represents a certain demographic that has not, I guess white men have been pretty well represented in American politics, but he's something different. And he sort of represents a break from the gerontocracy we've been ruled under. But the reason he's important to Book and Film Globe readers is because he kind of came up as a memoirist, right? That's how he first became famous. No one knew him when he was working in Silicon Valley or sort of, you know, schmoozing his way through Yale Law School, right? He became known because of his book Hillbilly Elegy, which at the time when it came out was considered a significant literary work, right?
Very much so. You want to talk about one of the best timed books in American history? This thing comes out, late spring, early spring 2016. Like, whoever greenlighted the book and then got it out in spring 20, I hope is spring of 16. I hope it's been promoted within Harper.
I'm sure they have. There's been a lot. The reason we covered it on Book and Film Globe is because the literary community, most of myself included, don't sell books at the volume
that Hillbilly Elegy has sold more books than thousands of writers combined. I mean, I've written three memoirs myself. I didn't think my memoir of being a marijuana addict or a yoga fiend was going to get me a political position. Although, wouldn't it be funny if it did? But what I'm sensing. I mean, obviously, like the lit world is very very liberal or left. Let's say left progressive, even left wing. And J.D. Vance is he's a conservative populist, and that's just not something that people who are literary or at least literary on Twitter are gonna respond to. So there's that.
Right.
But I also feel like there's a certain amount of envy in all the anti-Vance rhetoric.
Without question. There is. It's interesting. The book now and what Vance has become and even how his political views, or at least the ones that he expresses, have shifted versus the arguments and the world he told in Hillbilly Elegy have shifted somewhat. Now,
right.
Many, if you want to say, within the publishing industry, if you will, and then Hollywood in a small way when his book gets optioned into this bizarre Netflix.
Right, this terrible Netflix movie.
Terrible Netflix movie, but, by Ron Howard, pretty established member of the Hollywood elite, if you will.
Yeah.
But then, when it was published, this thing gets embraced significantly. It's not, look, a lot of books get written. You've written some. We know many authors who books don't get, reviewed. Now, certainly he had some contacts in the world and worked for Peter Thiel out in California and made some really good contacts. But this book gets reviewed everywhere by the, quote, liberal establishment. New York Times, Washington Post, all the biggies did big reviews and, made it popular. And then
because they were trying to understand the quote unquote Trump voter
right.
through the lens of this book.
But this and the story he tells, though why so many people embraced in some respect, yes, it was to understand the Trump voter, but it was within an argument that other books had made in the past about other groups. In some respects, that's what made it instantly, I think, consumable. It was a similar argument. In many ways, it was blame the victim. It's their own fault. They all, everyone in my community, or at least my grandparents' community, was doing drugs. My mother was screwed up. I'm the victim, but I got out up from the bootstraps.
Yeah, well, there's a reason why he's a Republican nominee and not the Democratic nominee. But it's just interesting to me that that book was embraced.
Embraced, and really, this is the answer, and this is how you understand, but because it told an old message that other books had, really talked about, and some other books that are even hated more on the whatever the left now, in the vein of Charles Murray,
Yeah.
And we, bell curve stuff, but then Charles Murray makes a pitch to say, hey, I'm just not the bell curve guy. It's now, white families are falling apart, as he did in his next book, and that book kind of got some attention. And then Hillbilly Elegy more or less does that book in kind of a memoir form, putting a face behind the statistics.
Yeah.
This thing is embraced by liberals across, the country. Oh, this is the Trump, look. And now they just have to get their act together and they can become just like J.D. Vance, too, a disciple of Peter Thiel.
Yeah, very. So there's some hypocrisy going on. I just find it interesting that this is a memoirist of all things is, if Trump is reelected, is one breath away from the presidency. Now, Barack Obama wrote a couple of memoirs himself, and I
sure
think he wrote them himself or with very little help. If any president in modern history could actually write a book, it's Barack Obama. But, the thing about his memoirs, there's sort of like the flip side of J.D. Vance's book. But the difference is that he was already an established political figure. He was a senator from Illinois, or he was about to become one. And so those books were obviously part of the ascension process to power for Barack Obama. The politicians always have a book.
And certainly most are terrible.
Yes. Well, exactly. So Obama's were good.
Yeah.
They were well written. They told a compelling story. They were actual books. J.D. Vance, when he published Hillbilly Elegy in 2016, it now apparent that it was part of a strategy,
right?
That he was playing three-dimensional chess against the world, but we didn't see it. But I didn't see it at that point. Like it wasn't even. It didn't occur to me that the guy who wrote Hillbilly Elegy is now the vice presidential nominee. You know, it's like, you know, it's as if somehow one of my memoirs had become a huge bestseller and I had then become a senator from Texas and was about to become Kamala Harris's vice presidential nominee.
Yeah, no.
Imagine the timeline.
It's going behind the scenes. And I don't think, you know, you wonder if, you know, obviously it was part of a political coming out for Vance. Who knows what his long-term thing was. But then you look at one of his mentors from Yale who really got him off the, you know, ground, Amy Chua, you know, who also wrote, you know, some huge books, but one that, entered into popular culture.
You mean the Tiger Mom?
Yeah, during the Tiger Mom. And she's his mentor at Yale Law School, who tells him, you know, don't bother going to don't go clerk. You'll blow up your marriage and, you know, do something else with your life. And he takes her advice. So he writes a book like she does. And, you know, it's a big victory for publishing, though you can imagine the Vassar grads, editorial assistants in New York, don't see it as such as
the Suris. Right. And here's the thing, like Hillbilly Elegy, like that thing is far and away the biggest best-selling book in the country right now.
Right now, yeah. It's all off the chains.
It's paying for those houses in the Hamptons.
the houses in the Hamptons don't build themselves. I mean, you know, you got to buy the land, then you got to build the house or at least renovate the house. And, you know, this is the publishing industry, a huge victory for publishing industry.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be interesting. I'm interested to know who's the editor who greenlighted this book. That's where, I mean, I'm very interested in that story, which I haven't seen. Who are the editors and who are the teams who say, hey, we got to pitch this in a certain way and have it come out in 2016? Because it had to have been greenlit, back in 2013, 2014?
Yeah.
Where's that story? Where do I got to find that? Do I got to go to Publishers Weekly? Are they still?
We'll work on it. We'll work on it on Book and Film Globe.
Those are the true American heroes. Those in the canyons of New York and then the corner offices, they're the kind of marketing folks who are kind of in the middle of the offices. Who are the deciders? It was a brilliant publishing move.
Indeed. All right, let's switch gears real quick and let's talk about Donald Trump. We published a piece on Book and Film Globe this week about Trump's newfound obsession with, quote, the late, great Hannibal Lecter, which to me is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. I can't help it. It's hilarious. You know, as our reporter Jake Harris pointed out, people think the reason Trump is referencing Hannibal Lecter is because Hannibal Lecter lived in an insane asylum and the Biden administration is giving asylum to lots of illegal immigrants. And that's the connection.
Right. Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah, I actually wonder where he's been saying like, it's like the Arkham Asylum is coming into, the Arkham Asylum folks are just like coming across the borders. It's only like sick people with mental health needs and all the rest. And they're all, I guess, Hannibal Lecter is the visual that he wants us to.
I don't know. It just, well, there's a few things that are funny about this. One, Hannibal Lecter is a fictional character.
Sure.
And also, even in the fictional world that he's depicted in, he's alive. So he's not late. He's a cannibal serial killer. And even more hilarious is that three of the four actors who have played Hannibal Lecter, Anthony Hopkins, Brian Cox, and Mads Mikkelsen, which, by the way, is an incredible triumvirate of actors, they're all still alive. So
maybe Harris should pick one of them.
Well, like Mads Mikkelsen?
Harris Mikkelsen, yeah. I mean, at this point, after these past couple weeks.
Right. I mean, who's going to – Kamala Harris going to start, referencing Marty McFly and saying we need to go back to the late, great Marty McFly. We need to go back to the future with him. I mean, the fact that, like, Hannibal Lecter is a talking point in American elections, I'm sorry. I know that there's a lot at stake here, Adam, but I can't take it that seriously.
You're right. And what's interesting is how many people in the general American public that probably know more about Hannibal Lecter just generally, even before Trump mentions it, than any of the people Harris is thinking for her vice president. Roy Cooper, you would get a blank stare. Hannibal Lecter, I'm trying to say his popularity rating in America, you know.
That would be the real coup if Harris would just name Hannibal Lecter as her running mate. It would just take the knees out from under one of Trump's.
More Americans would certainly know of him than some of her than who she'd pick.
I mean, he mentioned Hannibal Lecter in his nomination speech. can you imagine? Can you imagine? It'd be like Bill Clinton invoking Jeffrey Dahmer.
Right. Yeah, but to make a political point. Yeah.
Yeah, to make a political point. It's insane. It's insane.
Yes, it's insane. And that's where we are. But that's why you got to watch the movies and know your characters, because sooner or later they'll be in presidential nomination speeches.
That's right. And Book and Film Globe is on top of it. All right, Adam, why don't you go into the green room, and you can come out in about 10 or 15 minutes after we're done talking about Twisters, and we'll talk about Kevin Costner and the Horizon Saga.
Terrific.
We are professional tornado wranglers.
If you feel it, chase it!
Kids, do not try this at home.
Are those fireworks?
Yes, ma'am.
Our movie of the week is Twisters, and it is a big hit. And it's really not surprising that it's a big hit. It has a little something for everyone. It's a legacy sequel to the 1990s movie Twister, although it contains none of the same characters, other than a computer that can detect tornadoes. But even that only makes that computer named Dorothy only makes a brief appearance. Jake Harris wrote about Twisters for us. Jake saw Twisters a few weeks before it came out. Jake, hello, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing? Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm well. So you were very excited about this. You live in Dallas.
Yes.
Which is sort of Twister's country in a lot of ways. So why did you guys get to see it so early?
They came and did they invited a bunch of local meteorologists and some other media people to a screening a couple weeks ago. And yeah, when I got there, there was like a whole row of seats reserved for, you know, local Weather Channel people and everything. And everyone there was just talking about how much they loved the original Twister and how, especially for a lot of the meteorologists, that was what set them on the path to want to study storms and be weathermen, weather people. And so everyone was very excited to see it right before. And Daisy Edgar Jones showed up for a little bit before the movie and introduced it. So that was pretty cool.
This is the weatherest movie of the year.
Yeah.
There's a lot of weather. A lot of weather talk.
A lot of jargon.
So, yeah. So you really like Twisters. I got to say, you know, I mean, it's a damn entertaining summer picture, right?
It is the most fun that I've had at a movie this entire year. I was pleasantly surprised because, you know, the first one is, you know, it's, I think at the time, fairly mixed reviews on it. And I had not seen the movie in full, the original Twister, until right before I saw the new one. I'd seen the cow scene before, but seeing the first one really was, oh, this isn't so much a disaster movie as it is, you know, like, will these two estranged people get back together while also solving, you know, how will they warn people about the weather? And this one is very much, you have some of the special effects from the first one, but it is much more about these characters and the crew, which I thought was very interesting. And especially, I mean, when you have Glenn Powell and Daisy Edgar Jones as two members of that crew, there's no reason why you shouldn't just lean into putting the camera on them at all times.
Yeah, there's a lot of, they get a lot of camera time. I mean, the original was Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt, which, mm-hmm. you know, for the 90s was a fairly attractive cast, but
yeah.
They're no match for Glenn Powell and Daisy Edgar Jones. I mean, these are two of some of the more beautiful people working in film. But I also thought that, like, I don't know, the subsidiary characters, I didn't love Anthony Ramos, who plays sort of the third wheel in the relationship. I mm-hmm. thought he was actually kind of, his character was kind of weird and flat. But I loved, Glenn Powell plays this, this kind of rogue Ram truck driving, he's like a storm chasing hipster, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Like, and he's got like this ragtag multicultural band of misfits that he chases storms with. But I thought they were all actually, you know, pretty good, pretty well cast. I mean, Katie O'Brien was one of, you know, from Love Lies Bleeding is one of them. It was a lot of variety in mm-hmm. that crew.
Brandon Perea from Nope also was there. It was a highlight as Boone, the camera operator.
Yeah, he was
really
great.
Liked him. Yeah, it was. What I also thought was interesting was even the two lead characters are kind of remixes of Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt's characters from the first one. And the crew kind of is like a mix and match. You know, you take a little bit of Philip Seymour Hoffman, you take a little bit of Alan Ruck from the first one, and then they just kind of remix it for a new generation, really. But I liked that. I thought it was a really clever way to do that instead of having to shoehorn in some legacy thing of, you know, like maybe Glenn Powell would be Bill Paxton's son and he has to chase a storm to, you know, prove his family storm chasing legacy or whatever. Very glad they didn't go down that route for him.
No, instead, in fact, the emotional center of the movie is that Daisy Edgar Jones is a sort of a weather genius who from Oklahoma farm country, who experiences a terrible trauma when she's a young woman. Yeah. I mean, that opening scene was not only brutal and also just extremely well done. What an opener. I mean, what an opening. What a, you know, very, very nicely made and horrible. And, you know, she has a lot to overcome. So that's really sort of your emotional center of the movie. And Glenn Powell is really just kind of her like emotional support dog.
You know? Yeah, like the point is to get her back into her love for storm chasing and to overcome the trauma that she experienced at the beginning of the movie. And yeah, I wrote this in the review, but Glenn Powell basically plays him as if Matthew McConaughey woke up one day and was like, "I'm gonna chase storms. Yeah. And I'm gonna wrangle some tornadoes."
Right. He didn't really have a character arc. He was just there for eye candy. You know, I've been thinking about this movie actually because I mean I really enjoyed it. And I mean, talk about a four quadrant picture. I mean, there's so, you know, this is a movie that Red Staters can really, really sink their teeth into, like the rare Hollywood product that like it celebrates Oklahoma, the reddest of the red states.
Yes. And I was very surprised at how much it captured really the beauty of Oklahoma. They shot during actual storm season up in Oklahoma for this movie. And, you know, obviously the storms and the big tornadoes are CGI, but they shot around a bunch of the storms and then tried to digitally recreate what they saw up there to capture that. And I think a lot of that is to the credit of Lee Isaac Chung, the director, who previously made Minari, the Academy Award nominated movie about Arkansas farmland.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it makes sense to what a coup to get him. I was shocked when I saw who had directed this. I was like, really?
Yeah, I was like, how are they going to? I thought it was a Marvel thing almost where, you know, how is he going to put his own personal stamp on it without, you know, having the corporate structure of this thing get taken over because it's such a huge blockbuster. But right off the bat, there's just all these, I was really blown away by all the just loving shots of like there's farmland, there's wheat, there's just grass. The way he shoots the land is really reminded me a lot of Minari.
The small towns, the refinery, the refineries, the whole thing. And I agree. It's like, it's for a summer blockbuster, you know, I mean, and there are plenty of big disaster scenes in this movie. Don't get me wrong, but it's pretty artfully made, which allows you to sort of skirt around the kind of cheesy love triangle story that they never really, doesn't really end up going anywhere. But it doesn't matter though, because the set pieces, like the opening set piece is phenomenal. The set piece at the rodeo. Wow.
Yeah. And that kind of calls back to the drive-in theater set piece from the first one too, which I thought was a nice touch. And then that end one, when that happens at an actual movie theater, I felt was a nice little meta commentary. Like you're in the theater watching it happen to a movie theater.
And it was, you almost felt like the storm was going to blow through the screen at the Alamo. it kind of had that feel. Also, you mentioned this in your, review. It's like it's got kind of a great soundtrack of just like new country.
Yeah, and it was I think what they were trying to do for the marketing for this movie was just bring back all the 90s stuff possible, like the, you know, how they used to do soundtracks of music from and inspired by, and you know, half the songs on the soundtrack wouldn't make it in the movie. It would just be popular artists making songs about the movie. And that's how it is with this soundtrack. It's full of just new, like Red Dirt Country, or they expanded it out to some Nashville country artists. But it's all new songs, and all of them are about weather or Oklahoma in some way. And it fits the tone of the movie perfectly. I really liked that part of it. And then they also, apparently there's like a Twisters potato chip line, like merch tie-in stuff like they used to do for stuff back in the 90s, and it was
very old fashioned. Yeah, so it's got Red Dirt Country, it's got Oklahoma farmland, it's got like a rodeo scene. I understand why this movie made $81 million in its opening weekend, and it's got a strong female heroine and a multicultural cast.
Yeah, just it's ticking all the boxes. It's just, and at the end, it leaves it open for a sequel too. If you wanted to see, I don't know how they would continue to do what they do in the first one, but I'm sure they'll find a way at some point.
They're almost going to have to now that it's such a big hit. Well, Twister is a real surprise. Surprisingly, one of the better movies of the year, really. Who knew? Who thought?
I guess, Deadpool and Wolverine is coming out this weekend, so that'll probably take the crown again. But I think this probably has potential to be one of the top earners for the entire summer.
All right. Jake Harris, thank you so much. You be careful when you're driving around. You live up near tornado country, so you take care. The season's here.
I will. We haven't seen too many yet so far, but I'm crossing my fingers.
Don't be driving your ram into an open field in a lightning storm. Not a good idea, Jake.
Try not to.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Looks like we got ourselves a bad man right here.
We talked enough. In these territories, men will come try you. And they will take from you until you are wiped clean from this land. Use that much this year?
One of the most anticipated pop culture phenomena of the summer was Kevin Costner's Horizon, which was supposed to be a four-part film, a Western epic set in Arizona and some other Western states in the time of the Old West. And part one of Horizon came out, and I think it was 30 hours long or something like that. And it was a big flop, and then it was supposed to go to streaming, and it didn't go to streaming, and everything's fallen apart in Kevin Costner's Horizon Land. And we fortunately have a Kevin Costner expert on the Book and Film World payroll, and that is Adam Hirschfelder, who was here earlier, and he's back now. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Neil.
Did you enjoy your time in the green room? Did you eat the fruit snacks and the nuts?
Yeah, and the wine wasn't too bad either.
Oh, you had the wine, because usually people just drink the LaCroix, but it's fine if you want to. Lubricate your brain a little bit. Who am I to judge?
Watching Horizon, I think I need to.
Yeah, right. So you actually watched Horizon. You watched the part one.
I'm still watching it. I think I'm still watching it.
This was like 3.5 hours long, right?
Yeah, it's like the old day, like 3+ hours long of just with no, it just goes on and on. A very long film.
Right. And it's not even a full complete film. It's like, it's like part one of four. He made 12 hours of film, right?
Well, he's right now he's made about 6 hours of film. He's filming now hours 6 through 9. And then there's supposed to be hours 9 to 12, which will encompass part four and part 3 and 4. In theory, it's not clear if 3 and 4, if they're finished, if they get combined, how they're going to be seen. I'm skeptical.
Well, they released Horizon in theaters in June.
Yes.
You were away on assignment at that time. But you saw, as soon as you came back home, as soon as you returned from your secret mission for Mossad, you came back, and the first thing you did was go see Horizon.
Out of the country, the first thing you do when you get back to America is you want to go see a Western so you can really get up to speed on the American spirit and understand the country better, which is why Kevin Costner makes this film. So I went to see Horizon. Yes,
this is a Western, like an old fashioned meat and potatoes Western.
This is Western 101.
So you've got farmers and Union soldiers, and you've got cowboys, and you've got Native Americans.
The whole nine.
Women in gingham dresses, wagon trains.
The whole thing. It's just like the whole thing. Classic Western to the T. And, you kind of hope that Kevin Costner was going to be saying something new, and maybe he will after, the four parts or three parts or 3.5 parts are over. But it's just classic Western, like stuff you almost could have watched on TV 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, here's the thing, right? Like, I'm a fan of Western epics. Like, I loved Centennial when I was a kid, James Michener's Centennial. I loved Lonesome Dove, the book. In both cases, the book and the TV show, and then you had your revisionist Western, period of, Unforgiven. It's not like, the Coen brothers remake of True Grit, the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Like, there are lots of good products out there if you like this kind of thing.
There are tons, and Costner himself has done them. And Costner himself has really dedicated himself to doing Westerns, done some great ones. Look, Dances with Wolves, something he self-financed or a lot of part of. Broke some new ground in the world of Westerns, and that's great.
Yeah, what Pauline Kael once called plays with camera.
But you hope that they, you know, at least that there was going to be something new. But I just can't figure out what the decision making was about this and what he thought about the American audience, or at least the global one, although Westerns are not as popular globally. So you just wonder what the thought process one of just introducing all this character, all this stuff in scene one, in episode one, where then you definitely have to commit to episode 2, 3, and 4 to see a whole story. It's like a world that doesn't exist anymore outside of, you know, comic books and Marvel. And, you know, even those now people are pulling away from. And that, so I don't know, some strange decision making.
So Costner himself is in the movie, but he doesn't show up until like 2 hours into this.
Yeah, like about an hour and a half through some, you know, character rolling through town in the classic anti-hero way, protects, you know, gets involved with the prostitute, and they run, have to run off into the beautiful mountains. I mean, yeah, he's not the centerpiece. There's like 5 or 6 centerpieces somewhere, people you kind of follow, and but you have no idea by the end where they're all headed, presumably to the settlement of Horizon, where all roads are going to lead, we think. Yeah. But you're not totally sure.
But didn't we, and also, like, didn't we all, I don't know if you did, but I sat through every episode of every season of Deadwood and then the Deadwood movie that came out after that.
Yeah.
How are you going to top that?
Right. And you just, that's why you thought there'd be something different or what. He's got some big story in mind. He put a lot of his own money into this.
$100 million.
Yeah, $100 million across 4 films. But then everything changes up, as you noted in the intro. You know, chapter 2 is going to be out of mid-August. That's been pulled to give chapter 1 some legs to try to find some more people who are going to watch it. But, you know.
Well, it's not in theaters, and it's only pay on demand.
Pay on demand now, yeah.
On streaming. And no, I don't think anyone's demanding it.
In the middle of July, they're going to have to go free soon. But then the numbers stop working. And right. Then what happens with chapter 2? Who knows what they're going to do? I mean, they're obviously going to try to play off Yellowstone sometime in November. I'm sure that's going on.
And well, that's what I was going to bring up, right? Like, yeah. You know, your real entree into this world is that you are the world's most unlikely Yellowstone extended universe devotee. And, you know, Kevin Costner had the starring role in the Western of our time, Yellowstone, the modern Western.
The neo-Western. Right? He literally had – I mean, he rebirthed Western. He had it all.
The icon. He was like the icon of America. You know, he was like the J.R. Ewing on steroids of modern American Western.
He was the J.R. Ewing of like Trump Vance America. Like this was it. Yeah. Like this was it to perfection through, you know, his own incredible skills, Taylor Sheridan's incredible writing. This was the perfect character for the time.
It's like J.R. Ewing meets Tony Soprano and John Dutton. It meets the, you know, the lead guy from Succession. This is an iconic TV character. And Costner just pissed it away to pursue this passion project.
It's incredible. And to pursue this passion project, you know, who knows why he and Sheridan are fighting. There's the passion project. Then there's this, you know, moral death clause that Costner has that he didn't want. He wanted control over how Dutton dies. And that's an undercurrent as well. He wanted some editorial control of how Dutton ended his, you know, run on Yellowstone. I mean, it was the perfect character, which, you know, now it's a much more flattened entertainment world. Who cares if it wasn't the movies? I mean, Yellowstone was huge. This was a giant character in American culture who's not going to be in there at the finish of a series. Like, who the hell's in charge here?
Right. Well, it's such a bizarre. That's why, you know, I called it Kevin Costner, an American saga, because I mean, talk about shooting yourself in the foot with your Colt 45.
The whole thing, none of it makes any sense. All for a movie that is just complicated and a mess. Like, they had it all. They had it all. You know, you get lucky, as you said, the J.R. Ewings and in history, like historical characters, Tony Soprano. This was one of them. You're going to be in the top 5, top 10 of the big time American characters who people could point to and said, you know, something really said something about America in the times. And they throw it all away.
It makes no sense. It's like if James Gandolfini said before the final season of The Sopranos, you know what? I'm going to make my own 16-hour version of Goodfellas.
Right, I'm going to make my own, my own version of exactly like Goodfellas, or even something even older of some, you know, mafia film. I'm going to do it myself later. And people to this day, of course, are still fighting over the last scene. And I still, you know, I still chant, you know, or start singing, you know, "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow" from that last scene.
No, "Don't Stop Believing."
Don't Stop Believing.
They weren't listening to Fleetwood Mac. And then,
yeah, "Don't Stop Believing," you know, right. That's what you were headed towards, right? I mean, Gandolfini dies, of course, but yeah, like that's what you were headed toward. Just an iconic end that America would continue to talk about years after. And, you know, Sheridan filling that David Chase role of continuing to fight out why he ended it. Like, now what are they going to do? Have him in a car crash off screen? What?
Off screen. Well, they're, yeah. Maybe they'll have John Dutton quit the ranch to go self-finance a 12-hour movie about the American West.
Yeah, what's he going to do? Like, move to – he has his girlfriend in there. He's going to move to an ashram with her in India. Like, what – like, it's going to be interesting, but what a buzzkill, because they had built so much into around the Dutton family, and he was that just that connection between old and new, and I'm really disappointed. I'm just really disappointed.
Yeah, I would go so far to say that you're heartbroken, Adam.
Oh, no question. I mean, as you know, I've written for you earlier. You know, I bought the John Dutton, you know, Funko Pop. Like, it sits on my desk. Like, I am I'm heartbroken. I don't get it.
Kevin Costner, if you're out there listening to us, if you're one of the people who listens to us in Albania or the Gambia countries where this show is very popular, if you're visiting there, or if you're just on your private ranch somewhere in Wyoming, you've broken Adam Hirschfelder's heart. It is on you. All the sadness Adam will experience as he enters old age is on you. So,
Kevin Taylor, please fix this while there's still time. If there's still time, please.
All will be forgiven. All right, Adam Hirschfelder, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. I hope you had as much fun as I did.
As always, Neil.
All right. Thank you, Adam. You can see Horizon probably in one or two movie theaters, and then at some point on streaming services. Who knows when the rest of that film will actually appear before our eyes. Also, thanks to Adam for talking to me about the strange pop culture intersection of the Trump-Vance campaign and the literary world and the world of Hannibal Lecter, the late, great Hannibal Lecter. Also, thanks to Jake Harris for talking to me about Twisters, which is making a lot of money in theaters now. I am Neil Pollack. I am your host. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Stay safe, stay dry out there. Don't let the late, great Hannibal Lecter get you, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.